Beginning Sunday, IFC, the independent film channel, presents a six-evening, six-hour documentary about Monty Python's Flying Circus, timed to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the groundbreaking British TV series and comedy troupe. It's called Monty Python, Almost the Truth, The Lawyer's Cut. And our TV critic, David Bianculli, has this review.
It's good to know, after all these years, that the surviving members of Monty Python still can't even take themselves seriously. Oh, they have the best of intentions with this new mega documentary called Monty Python, Almost the Truth, The Lawyer's Cut. They really do want to explain where their peculiar sense of humor came from, and how the six of them met, and the inspirations for their most famous sketches, record albums, movies, and stage shows. But just as the original Monty Python's Flying Circus poked fun at the stiffness of the BBC when it premiered on the BBC back in 1969, this new documentary can't help but send up the documentary form a little. Its individual hours sport such titles as The Not-So-Interesting Beginnings and The Much Funnier Second Episode. And for the theme song of this new production, the Pythons not only resurrect the main title music from the life of Brian, but a dead ringer for the original vocalist as well.
Python, the brand new documentary of Python. It's a new documentary. It's about Monty Python. Unlike other Monty Python documentaries, this is brand new. It's a new documentary. It's not complimentary. But it's better than a hysterectomy. It's Monty Python.
There's an added joke in that each hour has its own theme song, which is sung with increased frustration over how endless the documentary is and how familiar the material. Obviously, the Pythons are sensitive enough to this charge to make a preemptive strike. After all, there was a 30th anniversary Monty Python TV special a decade ago, and a 20th anniversary one a decade before that. And home video collectors have had more than one opportunity to buy a Monty Python's Flying Circus mega set on DVD. But for such familiar terrain and such an old comedy group, there's a lot of new insight here. Enough to please hardcore Python fans, and intriguing enough to turn new viewers into probable converts. My favorite installment is the first one, which is generous with its clip from the early radio and TV shows that influenced or featured the future members of Monty Python. Peter Sellers and his infamously unstructured The Goon Show was one clear inspiration. The satiric stage review Beyond the Fringe, with Peter Cook, Dudley Moore, and Jonathan Miller, was another. And the British version of the topical variety series That Was the Week That Was, which, like The Office, was Americanized with a new cast, was a third. Some of the Pythons came from Cambridge, some from Oxford, and American Terry Gilliam came seemingly out of nowhere. But eventually, the six of them, Gilliam, John Cleese, Terry Jones, Michael Palin, Eric Idle, and Graham Chapman, found their own styles and voices. They presented a TV show where sketches were absurd and unpredictable, and where comedy targets ranged from little old ladies and dead philosophers to the Spanish Inquisition. Insanely imaginative animation linked one sketch to another. Or, as an alternative, John Cleese would simply stare into the camera and intone with the deep seriousness of a BBC announcer, "And now for something completely different." And all of it was completely different, then and now. From the Ministry of Silly Walks and the fish-slapping dance to the dead parrot sketch. Here's John Cleese returning a recent purchase to pet store owner Michael Palin.
"I wish to make it complete. Sorry, we're closing for lunch."
"Never mind that, my lad. I wish to complain about this parrot what I purchased not half an hour ago from this very boutique."
"Oh, yes, the Norwegian Blue. What's wrong with it?"
"I'll tell you what's wrong with it. It's dead. That's what's wrong with it."
Except for Graham Chapman, who died 20 years ago, all the other Pythons are alive and well and contribute fresh interviews to this documentary. There also are such well-chosen ingredients as clips from a British TV talk show back when Monty Python's The Life of Brian was released. John Cleese and Michael Palin appeared on the talk show to debate an angry bishop, and in these exchanges, Malcolm Muggeridge, a former satirist and author who had just converted to Christianity. He found the Pythons' biblical humor positively sacrilegious. In this clip, Cleese and Palin take on Muggeridge. Then Cleese, in a new interview for the documentary, recalls Palin's atypically biting reaction, which we then hear.
You keep making the basic assumption that we are ridiculing Christ and Christ's teaching, and I say that we are not.
But do you imagine that your scene, for instance, of the Sermon on the Mount, the scene in this, in your film of the Sermon on the Mount,
right,
is not ridiculing one of the most sublime utterances that any human being has ever spoken on this earth? Of course it is.
No, no, it's
absolutely
making fun
not
of the guy who's remembered it wrong and of the people who don't understand it and miss the point.
Well,
I think that's really unfair, because I think that a lot of people looking in will think that we have actually ridiculed Christ.
Yes.
Physically. Christ is played by an actor, Ken Colley. He speaks the words from the Sermon on the Mount. He's treated absolutely respectfully. The camera then pans away. We go to right to the back of the crowd to someone who shouts, "Speak up," because they cannot hear him. Now, I mean, if that utterly,
that utterly
undermines one's faith in Christ,
no,
then I think your faith cannot be turned
that
strong.
That was kind of fun. What was particularly fun, it was the crossest I've ever seen Michael Palin. Not a man is easily upset. It's almost apoplectic.
I started off by saying that this is such a 10th-rate film that I don't believe that it would disturb anybody's
faith. Yes, I know you started with an open mind. I realise that.
If I have a complaint about this 6-hour documentary, it's that it could have been longer. Eric Idle's recent musical Stage Triumph, in which he turned the movie Monty Python and the Holy Grail into the Broadway hit Spamalot, is covered. But we don't hear from David Hyde Pierce, Hank Azaria, or other members of that show, including Sarah Ramirez, now on Grey's Anatomy. And if Spamalot gets its due, why not other Python solo ventures, like Eric Idle's The Ruddles, All You Need Is Cash, Michael Palin's Ripping Yarns, John Cleese's Faulty Towers, or Terry Gilliam's Brazil? All of them brilliant. Yes, there's room for even more. And the DVD version of The Lawyer's Cut includes an additional disc, which does feature, among other things, the origin of Faulty Towers. But even if you just watch the televised version on IFC, you'll be quite entertained. And stay till the very end, because the credits on the last episode close with one final, very solid laugh. It's too good to spoil, but just like Monty Python, it's something completely different.
David Bianculli writes for TVWorthWatching.com and teaches television and film at Rowan University. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.
A documentary of the team.
Many years ago in Texas, a handful of Texas Rangers kept the peace over a sprawling land. There was even a formula to handle unrest. If you have one riot, you need one ranger. That was the legend anyway. Texas takes a different approach today. The Lone Star State has more than 73,000 sworn peace officers, roughly one for every 330 people. NPR's John Burnett reports.
Among the many entities in Texas that have their own peace officers is the State Board of Dental Examiners, which begs the question.
Have they ever had to say, stop, put your hands up, dental police?
No, not like you would think or see in the movies. Typically what we do is investigate white-collar crimes.
Like practicing dentistry without a license, says Lisa Jones. She's the enforcement chief who oversees a force of 7 officers at the Dental Examiners Board. It turns out Texas is just full of small, specialized police forces. The state insurance department has one, as do the lottery and racing commissions, the pharmacy board, and a handful of water districts. Others have tried but failed.
Why did the Texas Board of Foot Doctors want its own police department?
Hemant Macon is director of the Texas State Board of Podiatric Examiners.
That's a good question. To me, what police means are men and women in uniforms with guns who could attend to any 911 call. We didn't ask to be police. We had asked for a law enforcement standing, which gives us the ability to investigate crimes such as healthcare fraud.
But the legislature's House Committee on Law Enforcement drew the line there.
So why did you all decide that the Board of Foot Doctors did not need police powers?
I think you probably said it pretty much just in your question. Why did the foot doctors need a
police agency.
Joe Driver is the state representative who was chairman of the committee at the time. As it turned out, the podiatry board has withdrawn its request for its own cops, as state and federal authorities have beefed up investigations of health care or foot care fraud. The proliferation of boutique police agencies has raised the concern of the Texas Municipal Police Association. Their lobbyist, Tom Gaylor, worries that specialized police forces aren't ready for prime time.
What kind of resources does that agency have? Where are they going to take the person that's been arrested? What type of backup availability is there? One of the biggest concerns we have is what type of communication exists between that agency and the other agencies nearby.
And what are their use of force guidelines? On August 16th of this year, three peace officers with the Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission, which is charged with enforcing the state's alcohol laws, approached a suspect who was being pursued by the Austin police. The agents claimed the suspect tried to run over them. They shot him, and he later died. The incident is being investigated by the Texas Rangers. Tom Gaylor says with more and more peace officers out there, he doesn't want the public to get confused. The police association will be working with the legislature in the next session to define a peace officer.
We want it to be a cop is a cop is a cop. And if you see a cop, you understand what you're getting.
Meanwhile, the fastest growing category of new police forces is public school districts. 163 school districts in Texas have their own police departments, and more than a quarter of them have just one officer. Blooming Grove Independent School District is located in this quiet farming and bedroom community an hour south of Dallas.
My name is Gary Patterson, and I'm the police chief or the sole police officer of the Blooming Grove ISD Police Force, and you wear a lot of hats when you're just the only person.
Patterson patrols the halls of Blooming Grove High School, home of the Fighting Lions. A benign figure in his blue police shirt with a tonsure of white hair and a shambling gait. After a long career as a dispatcher for the state troopers, Patterson came back to the town where he grew up.
You're kind of like a father or a grandfather figure to a lot of them because you've known them since they were, you know, in elementary and you've kind of grown up with them.
It would be easy to criticize his position as one more example of superfluous Texas peace officers until you follow him around the school. He knows the kids by name. He knows their parents. He knows what's going on in their lives. He knows why they're in trouble. Patterson walks up on a boy sitting sheepishly in the corner of the lunchroom. The policeman already knows the youth has violated the school dress code and chose detention over paddling.
You're over here because you didn't have your shirt tucked in. So you have lunch detention for it one day?
It's either that or a SWAT.
Why don't you take the SWAT?
I didn't know how hard he hit.
I bet it's pretty hard. You done told your dad?
The Blooming Grove School District policeman pats the boy on the back and ambles back into the lunchroom to keep the peace.
Put your tail in.
John Burnett, NPR News.
Our next item might be called, if you must read this, okay, but please read it in a different way. That's what Chinua Achebe, the great Nigerian novelist, says about Joseph Conrad's classic, Heart of Darkness. Achebe, who's now 78, has just published a collection of essays, and we spoke recently at his home in upstate New York. In 1958, Achebe published his first novel, Things Fall Apart, which stood fiction writing about Africa on its head. In it, the world read about the coming of the British to Africa as Africans experienced it. Achebe first excoriated Conrad's novella about Africa back in the 1970s. In Heart of Darkness, the English sailor Marlowe steams up the Congo in search of Kurtz, the European gone native. Chinua Achebe says he grew up identifying with Marlowe.
Conrad was a seductive writer. He could pull his reader into the fray. And if it were not for what he said about me and my people, I would probably be thinking only of that seduction. And as a child growing up, one was the subject of Conrad's seduction. As you grow older, you suddenly realize, as I think I've said somewhere, that you were not on Marlowe's ship.
Yes, I found the essay in which you write. You said, a time came when I reached the appropriate age and realized that these writers had pulled a fast one on me. I was not on Marlowe's boat steaming up the Congo in Heart of Darkness. Rather, I was one of those unattractive beings jumping up and down on the riverbank,
okay,
making horrid
all
faces.
Right. I'm glad you got that so well. That's the point where you understand that there are two humanities. We are not all the same. And then I realize how terribly, terribly wrong it was to portray my people, any people, from that attitude, from that point of view.
The point of, I am the civilized person,
yes,
exploring and encountering the uncivilized, the people who are elemental and
yes,
live the
yes,
primeval existence here.
That's right. And he would give them names that are really unmentionable, describing an African working on the ship as a dog wearing trousers and attempting, obviously without success, to make something of the meter he was supposed to be watching. The language of description of the people in Heart of Darkness is inappropriate.
Of course, when you first made this criticism many years ago, Conrad defenders rose up and said, no, he was really an anti-imperialist. This is the description of the people of empire made of their imperial subjects. But Conrad wasn't sympathetic to them. You don't buy it.
No, I don't buy that at all. It's an issue that, for me, is finished and closed. Those who want to go on enjoying the presentation of some people in this way, they are welcome to go ahead. The book is there. I didn't carry it away. I simply said, read it this way. And that's all I have done.
That's Nigerian novelist Chinua Achebe speaking about Joseph Conrad's novella, Heart of Darkness. Achebe's new collection of essays is called The Education of a British Protected Child.
So that's how the experience of one state may influence the national debate. Now we'll hear how the healthcare debate reflects the experience of millions of individuals.
Democrats in the House want to change the rules for young adults. It would let you stay on your parents' health plan even after you grow up and move away. You could keep the coverage until you're 27.
That plan is aimed at young adults who are among the least likely to get insurance. To understand the choices that they face now, consider the experience of Molly Adams of Youth Radio.
So, what do? Is a question people ask a lot when you're fresh out of college. Basically, I'm a freelancer, doing all kinds of broadcast production jobs. But that doesn't cover my rent. So I'm also a bartender, and none of these jobs come with health insurance. A few weeks ago, before I was dropped from my parents' plan, I had an eye exam and a physical. It was like a last meal. I asked way more questions than I ever did before. I've even started flossing my teeth every day, something I never did when I knew I could go to a dentist if I had a problem. My mom told me she studied some COBRA information and that I could get a plan for around $300. Here's the thing. $300 a month is pretty much everything I make that does not go into rent, my school loan payments, transportation, utilities, and food. It's the only extra money I have. If I pay for healthcare, I would literally have no other money. I couldn't save. I couldn't buy winter boots. I couldn't buy anything. I have coworkers at the restaurant where I work who have never been able to put more than $2,000 into their checking accounts. And it's not just the artists. I know many people who are waiting tables or tending bar while they work two unpaid internships to earn a place in a company. That's why a lot of us are just not that into healthcare. It doesn't make a lot of financial sense. It's a priority for my parents because they need it. They're in their 50s, colonoscopies, mammograms, all that gross stuff. I have other things to think about. Plus, Dwelling on the fact I can't afford healthcare is stressful, and we know stress leads to health problems, so forget it. For now, I'm lucky. I don't have chronic health issues, and my safety net is having financially secure family members who could take care of me. But I do worry about a catastrophic event. I ride my bike a lot in a city filled with bad drivers. I worry about getting into an accident. And when I think about not being covered and maybe having to spend $20,000 on a broken leg, I admit I get bitter. Why is it that I'm working 40 hours a week, contributing to society, and yet I still don't have health insurance? Aren't I earning it? Maybe someday I will get hired full-time and score a benefits package in spite of the conditions that so many recent graduates are dealing with. A crappy job market and no health care. Until then, I have to decide between every extra purchase and health coverage. And right now, it really doesn't feel like a difficult decision.
Commentator Molly Adams lives in Chicago. Her essay was produced by Youth Radio. You can comment on it on our opinion page at npr.org.
Many of you have already heard this sound today. For me, it was a seltzer. The main ingredient in soft drinks, carbonated water, has been around for a couple of centuries, but scientists are still trying to figure out exactly how we experience the fizz of bubbly drinks. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce has this story on a new study examining cells in our tongues that respond to carbonation.
Lots of people drink sodas every day, but Nick Reba is not one of them. He says he probably drinks less than one carbonated beverage per week.
I'm a simple person. I drink ordinary tap water normally.
But he studies how people perceive tastes and became curious about the sensations produced by liquids loaded with carbon dioxide.
When you drink a carbonated drink, you really think that you're detecting the bubbles bursting on your tongue, don't you?
But Reba says there's some evidence that the fizzy feeling isn't just bursting bubbles. People have been asked to drink carbonated beverages inside pressure chambers, set up so that no bubbles can form.
The sensation you get is actually the same.
And that wasn't the only hint that bubbles weren't the whole story.
Another finding that was very interesting was that carbon dioxide produced strong nerve responses and taste nerves.
That intrigued Reba, who works at the National Institutes of Health. He collaborated with Charles Zucker, who's now at Columbia University, to explore how carbon dioxide acts on the taste system. First, using mice, they confirmed that plain old club soda did generate a response in a nerve that carries signals from the tongue's taste receptor cells. Then they did similar experiments using mice that don't have specific cells required to sense different tastes, like sour or sweet.
And in particular, we found that mice that are unable to respond to sour stimuli were unable to detect carbon dioxide with their taste system.
So these sour-sensing cells must be involved in the sensation of fizzy drinks. It turns out that these cells have an enzyme on their surface that interacts with carbon dioxide in a way that creates acidity. The cell then responds, as it normally does, to sour flavors.
So that's why we think carbon dioxide causes a taste response.
The results have just been reported in the journal Science. Earl Carstens has studied carbonation at the University of California, Davis. He says when he drinks a soda, he usually thinks of it as a burning or tingling sensation. And he says carbonation is known to stimulate nerves for things like touch or pain.
But this paper says there's also a distinctive taste component that you should be aware of, too. And it's distinctly different from just regular water. There's a carbonation taste, which is probably a slightly sour, has a sour component to it.
He says he's not surprised that this particular acid-producing enzyme plays a role. This enzyme is blocked by a drug for altitude sickness, and it's long been known that mountain climbers taking the drug can be disappointed when they get to the top and gulp a celebratory drink.
They noticed that when they drank beer or other fizzy drinks, the drinks no longer had a fizzy or tingling sensation, and they tended to taste like dishwater.
Carsten says it's not clear why the body's sensory system might have evolved to have a carbonation detector on taste cells.
I guess one reason would be if there's like rotting food that's giving off CO2 gas, you might want to be able to detect that. But otherwise, it's not entirely clear.
The deeper meaning of carbonation may be a puzzle for researchers, but for beverage manufacturers, its value is a no-brainer.
Americans spend about
$73 billion a year on sodas.
John Sisher is editor and publisher of a trade publication called Beverage Digest. He says if you look at the kind of things Americans drink...
The largest category is carbonated soft drinks. It's about twice the size of the second biggest category, which is beer, then bottled water, and then milk.
So, even if scientists say that carbonation triggers sour tastes, pain receptors, and perhaps even some kind of ancient alarm for rotting food, there must be some reason we keep reaching for fizzy drinks. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
One part of the real estate market that may be showing promise is green homes, energy-efficient houses that promote a more sustainable lifestyle. NPR's Adam Hochberg reports on one developer in Phoenix, Arizona, that's trying to lure suburbanites to the city with homes that are smaller and closer to mass transit.
The idea that Philip Beer is promoting may seem a bit counterintuitive in a sprawling metropolitan area like Phoenix. In this market, most of the housing stock was built since 1980, and suburban subdivisions advertise amenities like whirlpool tubs and media rooms. But Beer is trying to sell older tract homes in unpolished city neighborhoods.
We have a home from 1957. Not a whole lot's been done to it.
This is a very basic home, even by 1957 standards.
Mm-hmm. Five rooms? Yeah, including the kitchen.
Beer heads a company called Green Street Development, and he's betting that young professionals are tired of commuting into the city from the outskirts of town. So he's bought a couple dozen foreclosed homes at trustee sales, small ranches, 1,400 square feet or so, close to downtown and mass transit. He's renovating them now, making them a bit more modern and a lot more energy efficient. Beer hasn't sold any yet, but he's marketing them mainly to people who live in bigger homes in the suburbs.
It might be someone who works downtown that wants to have a walkable neighborhood. They can walk to the cafe, real cool cafe down the street. Or they can walk down to light rail and take it to work or to the ball game, spend more time at home, drive their car less.
That kind of urban living wouldn't be a novelty in cities like Washington or Boston, where there's long been a premium on decent homes near transit lines. But in Phoenix, where land is plentiful and cheap, most development has been in the ever-expanding suburbs. And only in the past year has the city opened its first light rail line. All of Green Street's homes are within a quarter mile of the line, and designer Amy Boubier promotes them as small, sustainable, and economical.
Now, I do see a change happening in that people are downsizing, and they're making smaller spaces more functional. People are less about it trying to impress and more about spaces that function well, that are well-priced, that meet their budget.
Because the homes were foreclosures, the developers say they can sell them below market value, even after the renovations. Most will go for $200,000 to $400,000. You could still get a bigger house in the suburbs for less, but Phoenix real estate economist Elliot Pollack predicts in-town living will appeal to a lot of buyers in an area where the average round-trip commute time is about an hour.
This creates a lifestyle that doesn't exist anywhere else in Phoenix. This allows you to keep your automobile in the garage instead of taking it out every day to commute to work. And so, yes, I think there's definitely a market for this.
Clay Richardson is considering buying one of the renovated homes. With his wife and two children, he now lives in a suburban golf course community in a four-bedroom house with the typical new home amenities.
See, you can see the backyard there. We actually have some mountain views back here.
Richardson says they're willing to give up their big master suite and granite countertops in exchange for a less hectic lifestyle.
We understand the trade-offs, but a lot of days I'm getting home at, you know, 8 o'clock, 8:30, and the children are in bed. I almost always eat by myself, and we're looking to spend more time with family.
The Phoenix area has seen a handful of other housing projects start to come up near the new light rail line, which so far has attracted more riders than its planners had projected. But most of that housing takes the form of more traditional newly built condos or apartments. The idea of doing green renovations to foreclosed homes is one that's rarely been tried in any city, and one that will be tested when the Phoenix developers put the first of their older inner-city houses on the market next week. Adam Hochberg, NPR News.